Welcome to the Exodus Cry podcast, where we have honest conversations around exploitation, trafficking, sexual culture, and justice.
Marcel, I'm so glad you're joining us for our Exodus Cry podcast. You and I have had a chance to connect in a number of different contexts around, you know, fighting this issue of human trafficking, online exploitation, and I'm really fascinated with your background and what brought you into this work. And I'd love for you just to give a little bit of a snapshot of how you got involved with fighting human trafficking.
So my career as a law enforcement officer started in 2002, a frontline law enforcement officer in South Africa. And that's where I stumbled across all things the sex trade, right? Sex buying, sex trafficking, etc. So I did a lot of work on the streets, and it was only a year or two later that I read an IOM letter, a newsletter, International Organization of Migration, kind of defined what human trafficking is. And then in 2004, with hindsight, I realized, but you know, I've been seeing this all the time, always had an affinity working with women and children, ended up with a child protection unit. And that's where I stumbled across a missing persons case, 15-year-old that went missing. And this led to kind of a national investigation, organized crime investigation into sex trafficking, money laundering, corruption, all of these things. And that blew up, literally, in the media, a lot of press, TV, radio. And it really kind of had international tentacles to it. And I was then drawn to our specialized unit in South Africa called the Hawks, or the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. And that's where I spent the last 3.5 years of my law enforcement career, then went into academia, but at the same time with academia, still assisting with law enforcement-related activities, consultancies, court testimony, etc. Did all the tertiary education, and that all centered around issues of human trafficking. And that's the long and the short of it. And it's, so it's been a bit more than 20 years. And really seeing all the different dimensions, you know, over the years, you know, sometime in Thailand, seeing what that looks like, Nepal, Mozambique, a few countries. So, and you see what those golden threaded consistencies are in all of this, you know, the different dimensions to it. So,
So came in through the law enforcement and then expanded through into academia.
Yeah, academia, and then at that time, you know, a lot of academic freedom, which allows you to do a lot of stuff, and then became, you know, at the same time, the case manager for the National Freedom Network in South Africa, you know, receiving cases. I mean, in the 10 years that I was a member of academia, in the same 10 years doing work with the National Freedom Network, I pretty much dealt with almost more trafficking cases. In that 10 years, more than 850 pieces of information that I've dealt with, which kind of eclipsed my work in law enforcement. And a lot of that could be ascribed to basically trust, you know, the trust deficit in the communities with law enforcement in South Africa, going rather opting to deal with somebody who's got law enforcement experience but no longer part of the system, you know. So that's kind of the different chapters to this journey.
Since you've had a chance to observe and study human trafficking more internationally, more globally, what are some of those, you described the thread, the common thread. What are some of those threads that you've observed that are common in different places around the world where trafficking is happening?
Well, unequivocally, that the economic principles of supply and demand is always part and parcel of it, right? Also, since the early days of my law enforcement experience, I grappled with a notion of academia, really. You know, I spent some time in academia kind of parachuting into a lot of these discussions, you know, where ideologies dictate what practitioners ought to think and know about the problem. I always had an aversion for that, and which then allowed me, when I entered into academia as a practitioner, being able to challenge a lot of those things, you know. So academia, people outside of the system, from a theoretical, hypothetical, ideological way, kind of dictating what many people think human trafficking, sex trafficking is, economic principles of supply and demand. And then also a lot of my work related to organized crime, pure and simple organized crime. And what I've also learned over the years, it's not so much a lack of education or poverty or a lack of opportunities that predicts human trafficking. Like, I mean, the fact that I'm poor, not necessarily that is the predictor of us, you know, or a person being trafficked. Rather, I would argue, and many scholars will argue, that corruption is the strongest predictor of trafficking, sex trafficking. A system where the rule of law is not in place, or a de facto decriminalized system when we're talking about sex trafficking, that's where human trafficking and impunity thrives relentlessly. And I've seen that in many parts of the world. And with our recent research here in the States, I mean, you could make that argument as well. What happens in cities and counties where conduct that's prescribed by law, like sex buying, those laws actually being enforced, and some parts of the country where those laws are not enforced. And then you see the empirical case for why we should be doing something like going after demand skyrocketing when laws are not being enforced. So it's interesting things. It's interesting dynamics that you do see these patterns and similarities in different contexts. You know, you've got these this golden threaded issues that emerges.
So would you say that the golden thread then is just at a fundamental level, supply and demand?
Supply and demand, and also
rule of law.
Rule of law and complacency comes at a massive cost.
Are there places where, like, conversely, are there places that where the rule of law is operating effectively, where there is accountability, where effective legislation is in place? Like, are there any places that you would point to and say, this country, this state is doing it well?
So let's think about the notion of rule of law, right? So you've got a piece of legislation. Some people might argue that first world countries, when we're talking about Germany, you know, first world countries, the Netherlands, New Zealand, rule of law, first world countries, you know, the poverty levels are not nearly as it is in some African context. The problem with that argument is that, you know, when you have a situation in those countries that I've just shared right now, where you do have legislation where sex buying is legal, you know, that's where the problem becomes obfuscated or concealed under so many different layers, where even the everyday Joe on the street is not able to identify what the problem is. So it's one argument to say, well, rule of law is great, but when we're talking about prostitution and sex trafficking, if you do have a situation where law allows men to purchase sexual access to the bodies of women and children, the evidence is going to be concealed and obfuscated. So, rule of law in the sense of legal models. What we see locally in the United States is, crimes or conduct clearly proscribed, law enforcement that actually works to act, you know, go after sex buyers or elements of the sex trade or sex trafficking. And it works. And I think that's where other parts of the conversation comes in around issues of dosage, you know. Doesn't help you do it once in a week and then for the rest of the month, we don't do anything about the problems. Also the application of law. It's one thing having a rule of law or, you know, a piece of legislation, but it's a paper tiger. It doesn't bite. It doesn't work. So it's all, you know, the same breath, it's also about the application of the law.
What would you say to the argument that by legalizing or decriminalizing the purchase of sex, that you create safer conditions for the women because they can be transparent about their work with law enforcement and they can be transparent about getting help or support services that they may need because it's legal? What would you say to that argument?
Firstly, we need to ask who is making that argument and on what is that based? What we are seeing...
For my part, it's not me.
Sure, absolutely. What we are seeing, I think this is a question we ought to be asking is, but who comes up with this research that shows this, right? And I mean, what we've seen over the years with research, and to put it very bluntly, in many ways, what we are seeing is the findings and the recommendations comes first, and then we seek the evidence to support those findings and the recommendations. It's almost like, you know, using a flaming arrow and shooting a flaming arrow at a blank wall, going to the flaming arrow and drawing a circle around the arrow and say, well, see, we hit the spot. And that's what we are seeing is happening in a lot of these research studies. When you look at the methodology, when you look at definitions like sex trafficking or human trafficking, that's fundamentally truncated, that's not legally binding, being used and being operationalized in research studies, you realize that fundamentally things fall apart based on the fact that victims of trafficking is often significantly undercounted in cases. If you use a label lens, and that's what a lot of these studies that support the idea that you know, within that environment there's access to services, etc., that's framing it from a labor perspective. And once you use a labor lens, fundamentally you undercut and you undercount the problem because you're not using legally binding definitions. It's kind of an ideological, theoretical framing of the problem, which is wholly dislodged from reality. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of these studies. And in fact, another word, harm reduction, you know, is another word that's often being proffered. And once you frame harm reduction, at the core of that is men should be able to buy because it makes the situation less hostile. It's ludicrous. It's kind of harm production rather than harm reduction, a lot of these arguments. So I think once you go beneath the surface, you do see that there's a lot of cracks in these arguments. It's kind of, so many of it is based on flawed research and studies.
I think what I hear you saying is just basically dismissing the notion that legalization or decriminalization would improve the safety of women in the sex industry. You're just dismissing that altogether because of
altogether
a faulty...
Altogether. Let's just use one example. Let's just look at New Zealand. Mm-hmm. What is happening in New Zealand at the moment? Remember, New Zealand is the paragon for full decrim. That's kind of the North Star of full decrim. If you look at
Just for a moment, for people that may not be trained in the language of what we're talking about, can you just give a quick definition when we say full decrim, what we're talking about?
So in New Zealand, effectively, the sex trade is fully decriminalized. So what that means is both the purchasing of commercial sex and the supply of commercial sex is legal. Third parties, brothels, etc., it's decriminalized. However,
and this is the crown jewel of the pro-sex work
that
movement.
That is the crown jewel example of the pro, what they would refer to as sex work argument. Everybody should follow the New Zealand lead. But just in the last 3 years, and look, the warning signs has been there all along. You know, when you hear people on the ground, NGOs that actually works with victims of trafficking, and they've said this all along, this is not working. Violence, sex trafficking is undercounted. And, you know, they are usually at the receiving end of a lot of antagonism and aspersions, etc. But just in the last 3 years, New Zealand has been downgraded, used to be tier one on the US annual State Department trafficking persons report. For the last 3 years, consistently, consecutively, 2021, 2022, and 2023, they're now being downgraded to tier two. But you need to actually read the reports to see what's happening in New Zealand. Victims are fundamentally not even identified. Law enforcement, the reports say unequivocally that law enforcement officials are hamstrung, or what they refer to it as legal limitations, to actually even enter a brothel. you know, they cannot enter a brothel without a complaint or a report of somebody being harmed or sex trafficked. And then there's also other agencies that are kind of the overseers of what is being reported to the police and what is not. So like the Ministry of Health in New Zealand, you know, they are kind of the keepers of this legislation. But reports are not being reaching the police. We see there are sections of the Prostitution Act that's being exploited by traffickers themselves. So there's so much problems there. And I think it's now coming to the fore. And we see the same arguments or the same evidence coming from, amongst others, Ontario Superior Court that just recently made a very, very important judgment where they dismissed a case by these lobby groups. The European Parliament, we had Reem Al-Salem, one of a senior UN figures around violence against women and children, that recently made a statement in support of the French law, which is also the equality model. So I think there's a sleeping giant that's rousing. You know, common sense is busy dictating that practically, theoretically, intuitively, you cannot claim that a system that allows men to buy sexual access to women and children, you know, it's the antithesis of equality and gender equality. So I think, and I'm excited, I think there's movement and the needle is moving. And 2023 has been a good year in that space.
You become so articulate of the issues pertaining to supply and demand. And it's obviously a huge passion of yours, as it is mine. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing with NCOSI, the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, addressing the legal aspects of this, because I share your passion, but we primarily are working on the film and messaging and campaigning side of this. Why did you become so passionate? What has like stirred your interest in going after this specific thing? What brought you to NCOSI, which, side point, we are great friends with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, Don Hawkins, and everybody that works there. So we love NCOSI. We feel that you guys are a great comrades and allies in this space. How did you get to NCOSI? What has really stirred your passion for this specific issue of the supply and demand part of this?
So I think part of it is, you know, how I kind of became immersed in all of these issues, right? As a frontline law enforcement officer. I mean, doing work using kind of asymmetrical or unconventional ways of investigating this. I mean, 3 years I spent in the field almost full time, and so many instances in those 3 years between 2015 and 2017, I spent a lot of time having conversations with sex traffickers in brothels, you know, women in brothels. You know, I'm married to this amazing woman who, Caroline is her name, and when I was still a frontline law enforcement officer, I received calls in the middle of the night, you know, women calling and saying, listen, because this is the people that I used to work with, right? Who report, you know, you gather information and intelligence, you know, asking me, can we just sit and speak? I'm hungry, you know, need a cup of coffee. And so many of these people became very, very close friends, you know. And the sad part is also, conversely, how many of them died because of suicide, you know, because of illnesses and violence. So this has just, I mean, you know, I think it's a certitude that comes from seeing the actual harms. It is not theoretical. It's not philosophical or ideological. There's no way that you can sugarcoat this. There's no way that you can rationalize any of this harm. And I think once you then enter academia and you realize how the ivory towers allows you to create whatever narrative you want to, that's just, it's just wrong. It's not normal. It's the way it should be. And I knew about Exodus Christ's work. I knew about NCOSI's work when I was still in the police. So it was just kind of a natural progression, you know, philosophically grounded in the notion that on a very, very basic level, you know, we need to create off-ramps out of prostitution, not more on-ramps into it, as academia say we should, or as some misinformed policymakers and politicians say we should be doing. It's just wrong. Research doesn't support that. And the research that is often proffered in support of that is fundamentally flawed, you know. When you really, really delve down into how definitions are used, etc., and biases and you know, etc., it's just not explicated by researchers and funding. And then all of these things come together, and it just makes for a terrible situation for creating evidence. And in many ways, it boils down to the production of ignorance and the production of harm. And the knowledge prostitution is maybe another word that we should be using. And a lot of that comes from academia.
Why do you think that the pro-sex work narrative, the idea that, you know, sex is work, the idea that this is somehow empowering or sexually liberating, that it's a human right, why do you think this narrative has become so popular?
You know, just a few minutes ago, we spoke about the word harm reduction, which is a go-to word for why, you know, we should remove all laws governing the purchase of sex. And I think that word also stems from a former word, which is the issue of human rights. I mean, you know, human rights, the word human rights, I mean, we know it's a powerful word. It means different things to different people. And some of the foremost human rights organizations out there use the, you know, the banner of human rights to say, well, this is fundamentally part of, immutable rights that every human should have in some way, shape, or form. And we can go into the history, which obviously dates back to the 70s, in the early 80s, that led up to the Palermo Protocol, where groups against the idea of a legal sex trade or abolitionists clashed with, feminist groups who claimed that, well, all of this should be legal. And all of that culminated really in Palermo, Italy, during the Palermo Protocol, which was kind of the landmark international treaty that kind of defined what human trafficking is. That's where the first battleground was around this. But I think to your point is, I think there's many ways that we could probably frame where all of this comes from. And we see that permeate so many other things, you know, issues of pornography, so many other issues. You know, we don't want to go into that, all of that now, probably. But and now we see, and I think, you know, just coming back to the issue, I think the veil is now being lifted around a lot of this stuff. And it agitates people, it provokes people, and it gets very nasty, you know. And you see how all of these conversations spills over on social media. And I think many voices are omitted, chiefly survivors of the sex trade, who ought to be the ones who should be speaking about their own lived experiences and how this idea of human rights and liberty is entirely dislodged, you know, from their experiences, law enforcement experiences, prosecutors' experiences. And often you listen to these debates and you realize it's like the wheel is turning, but the hamster is dead. Something is wrong here, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of a bizarre, obsessed fixation with the idea that any tempering or restrictions or, as you mentioned, governing laws around the issue of the buying and selling of sex is disastrous to their existential position. And I think that's, to me, the thing that strikes me as the most kind of like bizarre around this is the lack of an ability to have a conversation, to have any critical feedback or analysis without just utterly triggering those individuals on the other side who are, you know, trying to push this at what seems like an irrational cost, like at, you know, no matter what, we're going to pass these laws. We're going to enforce this way of thinking. It's going to be in our movies. It's going to be in our television shows. It's going to be in our culture. It's going to be in our laws. And anything short of that is evil. And it's very interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think the hubris with which that is being done is astounding, you know. And there's also a part of it, you know, the whole thing, there's also cognitive dissonance. You know, you literally put the evidence on the table and say, this is what's happening in our courts. This is transcribed. This is the evidence that's there. And then, okay, well, then the cherry picking of data comes. So, I mean, a lot of these studies, coming back to your earlier questions, Benji, but what about the research that shows, or, you know, claims that this is liberating and less harm, etc.? Well, a lot of that studies, and many of these studies, has not even a single citation that comes from the criminal justice realm or the criminal law realm, you know. So, so you've got the cherry picking of data to pretty much fit the narrative, you know. And I think it's just blatant dishonesty. And I think that's why, you know, that's why this message should be a dripping tap. You know, the idea that this is wrong, it doesn't work, you know, it's not liberating. You cannot rationalize the harm. You know, this does not contribute to a society of human flourishing and human dignity. In fact, it's the antithesis of this. This is not a human rights issue. You are actually doing men's rights work instead of women's rights work. So I think it should be challenged, and we should never sit on the fence around this. And the same message that I have to, you know, organizations elsewhere in the world, you know, you cannot say or claim to be, you know, combating sex trafficking if you're not combating demand. You're not. Then you're not doing combating sex trafficking work if demand is not front and center of what you do. So...
Hi guys, this is Benji Nolo from Exodus Cry, and I'm just so excited to announce the release of my new book called Raised on Porn. This is something that I've been working on for the past 10 years, and just excited to get it into your hands to help deepen your understanding of porn, its impact on our world, on our lives, and what we can do to heal from it. And so I think you're going to find this to be an extremely insightful and helpful resource, whether you are somebody who is struggling with porn consumption, whether you're a parent and wanting to help have better conversations with your kids and protect your kids, whether you're an educator, whether you're in a relationship and this has in some way affected your relationship, I think this book's going to be a super helpful resource. I wrote it in such a way to be that resource that I wish was there when I started into this. So it's both comprehensive and in-depth. And if you're looking for a one-stop shop, so to speak, I think this is that book that you can get a hold of that's really going to give you the big picture and an in-depth way of how porn is affecting our world and us as individuals and our relationships and our children. And again, what we can do to heal, to find freedom, to better our society. And so I encourage you, get a hold of this book, Raised on Porn, and share it with a friend as well. Thanks so much.
For people who are listening to this and maybe get tripped up over, well, you know, there are those who are trafficked, and then there are those who enter prostitution voluntarily, have, I think, trouble sometimes with these conversations because there's an assumption that, well, there are those who enter this willingly, voluntarily, and then there are those who are forced into this. Is there anything that you would say to speak to that situation? If somebody goes, okay, well, I hear what you're saying, but what about those who have entered this voluntarily and would like to speak for themselves, and what about their experience of how great prostitution can be and that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
Yeah, and I think it opens up a whole different conversation as well, is in terms of, you know, and let's look at research. Let's look at what evidence suggests. You know, how many women end up in prostitution because of predisposing, structural inequalities, you know, whether it's education or homelessness, drug addiction, poverty, etc. You know, a lot of those are drivers. And then you could argue, well, there is university students or college students that's now opting to do this. You know, there's also studies that talks about ACEs, you know, adverse childhood experiences. And if you really want to go and you look at the margins of this conversations, I do agree. I have worked with women who are very unequivocal and say, well, you know, this is what I do. This is the lifestyle I follow. And you know, that's a choice that people make, you know, and if that is a choice that you make, that's your choice. But those are so marginal, Benji, you know, if you really dig down and you have one-on-one conversations with people, so many of people at the front end of these lobbying are put under so much pressure from a messaging perspective. You know, I know where I come from, you know, where people receive stipends to be part of these organizations that say, you know, quote unquote, sex work is work, you know, nothing about us without us. That's usually the messaging around this. And even in that, there's just, this convenient omission from all of these different other factors and variables that's not factored in. So,
I've heard human trafficking described as the dark side of globalization. And I've heard human trafficking talked about as the dark side of capitalism. And I think that human trafficking in many ways embodies and represents this demographic of people who have fallen through the cracks of a society that has failed to account for the vulnerable. And I've also heard human trafficking described as the exploitation of vulnerability. So when we think about these things, we think about these factors of globalization. The world has become a smaller place by virtue of technology, travel, internet, you know, being online. Capitalism is, you know, I can make these pair of jeans for $10 and then somebody else down the road says, well, I can make them for $5, you know, forget how those genes are made. It's very bottom line oriented, but it is ultimately also the commodification of everything. And so in that way, humanity itself begins to become commodified. And I think that human trafficking and the larger global commercial sex industry is reflective of an emblematic of a society that is willing to commodify people in the most kind of visceral and violent and way through these means of giving men access to bodies for a cost. And the exploitation of vulnerability that I think is also a helpful definition as people begin to understand what's going on in our world. Why are there 42 million people trapped in the commercial sex industry around? It's looking at those vulnerabilities, looking at globalization, looking at the way in which, you know, capitalism has contributed to the commodification of everything. These are all important factors in this conversation, I think, to help people understand why human trafficking exists in our world today and some of the underlying things that we can do to begin to push back against it. But in that, I want to just kind of pivot our conversation to talk not just about some of the more traditional aspects of how predominantly women and children are accessed by men in prostitution. Some things you've mentioned, brothels and, there's escorting, there's street prostitution, there's these different avenues through which people are trafficked or sold for sex. But now so much of this has moved online. Can you talk about and help me understand the online criminality aspect to people being bought and sold for sex?
So just to connect that with your previous statement around globalization, I think we should also start talking about the globalization of indifference, because that's really what's also happening. And a big part of that is, again, the online environment and pornography. You know, there's overwhelming research in terms of what pornography does, you know, in terms of scripts and disinhibition, etc. But then the nexus between pornography and sex trafficking. I mean, you know, we've just done some research now on that, and it's very clear. You know, young pornography is used to groom young victims of sex trafficking who lack sexual experience. We know women and children are trafficked for the production of pornography. You know, no longer do we just kind of theoretically talk about that. We know this. We know that men use pornography as a kind of a sexual enticement before they actually go and purchase sexual access. We know that men act out what they see on pornography. The research is there to show that. We also know that men who frequently use pornography are three times more likely to purchase sexual access to women and children than men who do not access pornography frequently. And again, all of these things interweave. And I think what's happened with the online environment and technology, it's now finally we can see that none of these issues, whether we talk about gender-based violence, whether we talk about torture, you know, that's another aspect which we don't always talk about. Prostitution, sex trafficking, none of this exists in its own private universe, you know. And ultimately, when you look at the online environment, you know, usually men, you know, overwhelmingly men, are the ubiquitous factor in all of these things, you know, that there is a male, overwhelmingly male, behind every transaction. So, and I think that has led, that has kind of amplified indifference, harm. And I think a lot of the things we see in society now, the fact that you have large gatherings where there are children, men parading around naked, kind of exhibitionism, etc. If you look back at you know, I thought about it recently, and it's kind of more a hypothesis, but if you look at the parents taking the kids to these shows, if you think about their age when the explosion of pornography in the online environment, I wonder, is this the chickens coming home to roost now? And when you look at all, you know, pornography platforms like Pornhub and all of these tube sites and what is available on there. I mean, we're talking from bestiality, torture, you know, racism, everything is on there. And people, normal people, everyday people consume this. And I think all of this can just create this absolute oxygenation of harm, violence, sex trafficking, etc. So I think that's where we need to start embracing a complex systems view around this, you know, how complex systems work. And then a lot of this begins to make sense, the fact that there is these non-linear interactions between men being able to purchase a sexual access, pornography, sex trafficking, prostitution, money, corruption, impunity. If you think about how a lot of these big tube sites, pornography sites, are able to get away with this, it's just mind-boggling. And I think,
I can see how those factors all work together to kind of create this situation where, you know, companies like Pornhub are able to thrive. If you think about the demand side of it, if you think about the corruption, if you think about like the technology that exists, these different factors have created this sort of perfect storm. What's interesting to me is that it's a storm of violence and exploitation, gender inequality. And yet is rebranded as something sexually liberating and empowering, and you know, when it comes to porn, something that's a bit edgy and erotic. And you know, we have these ways of reframing something that is so evil and violent and corrupt and repulsive and exploitative as something beautiful and powerful and amazing and sensual and all of this. And I think that's where a lot of like these conversations can be helpful. It's the reason why we do this podcast, is to help kind of pull back the layers and help people see the deeper truth that's at work when we talk about like these issues. There is an abscess in our culture, whether it, you know, is the corrupt pornography industry, whether it's the exploitative commercial sex industry. And I think the hope for me in having these conversations is that by articulating the deeper truth, that more and more people would begin to change their relationship with these things. Because with the point that you started off with, you know, the supply and demand issue, I think if we can reach more men with the truth about what they're participating in, I think is where we could see a lot of change happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, again, coming back to the issue of rationalization, I think once you reconcile, and I think that's what a lot of people push back is seeing their fingerprints, footprints, and DNA on all of these harms. And once you start looking at it and you look at your own role, then you realize everybody's pretty much complicit in this. And that's where there's a deficit of collective compassion and deceit, you know, and there's this Turkish proverb that talks about the forest was shrinking, but the trees continued to vote for the axe because the axe was clever and convinced the trees because his handle was made of wood. He's one of them. And I think we are being deceived. And I think that's why these conversations, again, to your point, unlayering it, demystifying it, and helping people to understand we all have a role in this, you know. Men has a role in this, you know. And I think we need to create a system where, you know, you know, I spoke about this recently, the question, how do we create a system that looks remarkably similar to the one that perpetrates it? How do we disrupt that? Yet a system that instead of creating harm allows for human flourishing, a system that creates accountability instead of impunity, one that's transparent and not translucent. How do we create that? What can we mimic from this broader system? And once we look at from a complex systems perspective what works, there's so many things that we can mimic from a messaging perspective, from a paradigm shifting perspective. And it's not a pipe dream. This can happen. It can be done. But it's going to require some sobering conversations and not sitting on the fence. Way too many people are sitting on the fence around these issues. And yeah.
Talking more about the online aspect of exploitation and criminality, can you help us understand how that works? Like, what is the experience of a young person growing up online today? Where might they be vulnerable? What do parents need to think about in consideration of the world their children are entering online and sort of the dangers available there or present there?
Yeah, so I think what we are seeing so much of the grooming, right, is happening on very, very well-known, applications, you know, where child sexual abuse material or suggestive content can be shared within a kind of a peer-to-peer in environment. And Apple recently made available technology to anybody who really wants to use it. Other platforms can start using it, which kind of blurs or kind of flags, you know, sexually suggestive or explicit content on some of these chat sites. So it's still the phone, you know, the brothels of this world are still in our pockets and children has got access to phones. So it's how do we default to safety? So it's for parents to understand, you know, what can they expect from service providers? What is the capabilities and how do we affect safety online? But that's where predators continue to roam free, you know, is the online environment. And now with the addition, a lot of our work centers around the issue of artificial intelligence, now you've got AI girlfriends and AI boyfriends, and that just layers it with another layer of complexity. And this is where big tech and developers needs to be held accountable in terms of algorithmic accountability and transparency, etc. But it's pretty much just, you know, don't leave it over to the iPad to do the work that a parent needs to be doing, because the predators are out there. They know this, you know, and they pounce on it.
I know you guys are doing a lot to push back against online exploitation and criminality. At some point, I would love to dig deeper into that with you. I don't know if we'll have time today, but I wanted to talk about, so maybe you can just mention in a nutshell some of what you guys are doing in that space. But I wanted to end our conversation today picking back up where this whole conversation started, which is about supply and demand. It's been a point of interest for me in a very heightened way over this past number of years. I've been working on a film on demand and touring that film. And the issue has come up of men's sexual health. And people on the side of advocating and pushing for the pro-sex work agenda would suggest that by removing any criminal accountability for the purchase of sex, these men will have access to sex, and that will contribute to their sexual health and them being, you know, sexually whole people. You hear a lot of these arguments that are used, if these are just lonely men who, you know, just need the comfort of a woman and their social skills aren't so good. You know, you've heard these arguments presented. So in your view, how might that actually work in reverse and be detrimental to men's sexual health? And what do you suggest for men who live in now this world that is so sexually activated and heightened because of the omnipresence of pornography, and yet are struggling to find a healthy outlet for and nurturing of their sexuality? What do you suggest for men related to this issue of men's sexual health?
I think many men, whether that's wittingly or unwittingly, would agree that pornography doesn't love you back, right? I think there's increasing research that shows the effect of pornography on issues such as loneliness. You know, it deteriorates relationships, you know. And then also men acting out on pornography. And there's some great examples in the movie that Exodus Cry have made buying her. You know, the full knowledge that this is not the answer to wholeness or to happiness, etc. I think it's coming to heavy. I think what we probably need is a probably very kind of aspirational, but really a global dialogue, really, in terms of where does happiness, contentment, meaning in relationships really stem from? You know, what kind of relationships make us feel you know, dignified, happy, content, at peace? And because the systems currently that we engage and that we seek that, and that many people seek that from, it's not working. From a mental health perspective, I think we know, you know, it's unprecedented, you know, the mental health issues that there are. And again, calling this out, you know, when these statements are proffered is to push back with ever-growing research that's coming to the fore and saying, well, pornography is not where health or happiness is being found. You know, and I mean, that research is also piling up. I think there's a... there's a collective realization. I think there's a lot of good things happening. I think there's a lot of research that's coming to the fore that's questioning from people that's not ideologically bound by, while pornography is liberating, purchasing sex is good for men's sexual health, etc. So I think research is important, and I think to have fireside conversations around these things. I mean, men is part of the conversation. You know, men speaking with men. So yeah, if you just think about it, if every man have a conversation, you know, whenever he overhears somebody speaking about pornography or, you know, kind of objectifying women, I really think that can have an immensely compounding effect, you know?
Absolutely. It's interesting because like in the world of, you know, male endeavors, I don't know, for lack of a better term, there's a big emphasis on, you know, physical health. Even now on mental health is becoming a bigger thing now for men to talk about. So there are like conversations about the way that we can improve through athletics, things like jujitsu. There's a growing community with an emphasis on those things. And yet the conversation about men's sexual health is still so absent from a lot of these more normal conversations. And I think by virtue of that, a lot of men do live lives in a way of like quiet desperation. And so I think that's a big question mark for me of how do we create a conversation around men's sexual health? How do we cultivate our own sexual health and encourage others in that? Does it look like accessing pornography for self-gratification? Does it look like accessing a female body for a price? You know, and if so, what's underneath you? Do you really believe that that's contributing towards your sexual health and your mental health and your relationship health and your overall well-being as a person? I think if we had those conversations, then we quickly realize that no, it's not contributing towards that. It's compromising those things. And so I'm inspired by this conversation. I always really love talking with you, Marcel, whenever we get together, because you have thought about these issues so much and you've invested so much in researching and talking with survivors. And I always get inspired and I feel like we've kind of set the menu for a couple other conversations that where we could steer this about men's sexual health, about the online world. And
what do we replace it with, right? I mean, there's a vacuum, mm-hmm. there's a hole, and it's being filled with stuff that, you know, that doesn't help. So I think it's a very deep, it's a conversation that needs to be had. And yeah.
Absolutely. So to be continued, but any last thoughts, anything, any shout out you want to give about the work that you guys are currently engaged in and Cozy, or just anything at all that's on your heart to share before we wrap this up?
Yeah. Well, I just really appreciate the work you guys do, Benji, you and Helen and Sloan and the rest of the team here in Exodus Cry. I think, you know, you continue to make an indelible contribution to understanding these issues. I think your work and just, you know, watching Buying Her last week in preparation for another event that we'll be doing soon, you know, every country, every signatory of the Palermo Protocol, you know, Palermo Protocol countries who, you know, domesticated human trafficking law in their country. I believe every country, decision makers, policy makers should be watching that. So really shout out back to you guys and the work that you've been doing, being in the arena. I mean, we all know the pushback that comes. We'll probably have some comments probably somewhere around here in, you know, on the links that doesn't agree with any or most of these parts of the conversation. But thank you to you and everybody out there who continues to show up, you know, and put themselves on the line to,
Good. Well, grateful for you coming and sitting down with us, and we'll do it again soon. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thank you,
thanks for that encouragement. Appreciate you, brother.
You can check out all our podcast episodes, articles, and films at exoduscry.com and join the daily conversation by following Exodus Cry on all major social platforms.